Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes teenagers the thrill-seeking, threat-ignoring, moody, and distracted creatures they are, and how can all those maddening tendencies possibly help them on the road to adulthood? Most people will hear the exasperated question, "What were you thinking?" more than once from concerned adults in their lives. But while it might seem to us grown-ups that they aren't thinking at all when they take risks, downplay consequences, and suddenly find that there is nothing so socially suicidal as being caught hanging out with their parents, you can take hope. As journalist David Dobbs writes in the cover story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine, scientists now understand that the teenage brain is exquisitely adapted for the difficult tasks of adolescence. The article is called Beautiful Brains, and we're happy to have David Dobbs here to talk about it. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We should say that in addition to the reporting you did for this story, you were also a dad, which makes you a sort of permanently embedded journalist.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I am an embedded journalist. I have a boy who's now 21 years old who, as I tell at the opening of the story, had his own share of adventures during the teen years, one of which included being pulled over by the state police for doing 113 miles an hour on Interstate 89 up here in Vermont. And as I described, that's obviously not a good or smart thing to do, but he wanted to explain to me at the time that he did not do it without thinking, in other words. As you were referring to earlier, we always accuse these kids of just not thinking. They're just thinking of other things. He had thought it out quite deliberately about where he would do it and made sure to pick a dry road in broad daylight, empty road, and so on. And he wanted to make that clear to me. The one thing that irked him about the ticket, he was charged with many violations, and it cost him about $1,000 altogether, which he worked all summer to pay off. But the thing that irked him was that he was cited for reckless driving, which he understood was reckless in one sense of the word, but in the sense of unthinking, he said it was not reckless. That incensed him a little bit.
And from his perspective, yes, he craved the thrill, but he didn't believe he was invincible, and he didn't care about hurting anybody.
Exactly. No, he was very concerned that he not hurt anyone, other than himself, perhaps, and his buddies that were in the car with him, which is why he picked an empty stretch of interstate in daylight. And the research has made clear that when you're a teenager, you actually do think almost as well as an adult does. You think about risk in mainly the same ways. You don't weigh the future quite as heavily as an adult will do. But the main thing that changes when adolescents think about risk or confront risky situations, it's not that they devalue the risk. They tend to, in some situations, place a higher value on the rewards of taking a risk, which is why they will make different decisions than adults will about taking risks.
So let's step back here for a minute and talk about the changes that take place in the brain from the ages of about 12 to 25. Brains are nearly finished growing larger at the beginning of that time, but they're still changing a lot.
Yes, and this is fairly new evidence, fairly new data, something they found out starting in the 1990s when brain imaging got sophisticated enough to really look at the different parts of the brain and see what they were made of and what size they were and so on. And a long study started in the early 1990s, tracked a bunch of kids who, beginning when they were 4 or 5, tracked their brain development right up into their 30s. And at the time, these researchers at the National Institute of Health, doing this work with tax dollars, at the time they started it, they thought they'd have to do this for about 5, 7, maybe 10 years because they expected to find that the brain was finished developing by age 8 or 10. But the brain just kept developing, and they kept extending the study, and they finally had to extend it all the way up to age 30 with these kids to see a point at which the brain's development, not its growth, but its development, more or less leveled off. Not completely, but clearly kind of reached a plateau. So this generated a whole new story about the brain and has led to all kinds of neat science, but the story that it led to about adolescence was that, well, their brains aren't done that. They aren't done yet. That's why they act the way they do. They're sort of, in some of the articles about this, these findings portrayed them as, actually some of them as akin to mental retardation. Their brains aren't fully adult brains yet. So that was the narrative for a little while. And when I first looked into this in 2005, that was the dominant narrative among scientists. When I went back and re-reported this study, this story in 2009 and 10, the story among many of the scientists was different. They were interpreting the same data differently. Instead of telling a story about a defective adult brain that we all carry around in our teens, they were now talking about a brain whose flexibility and openness and eagerness for new experience is exactly what you need when you're at that stage of life.
So you say eagerness for new experience, I say thrill-seeking and risk-taking, but basically they're all part of the same process of moving out away from the comfort of mom and dad's home and starting your own life.
Very much so. And what is clear in the data is that we, in our mid-teens, three traits that we carry throughout our lives peak then. They reach a sharp peak. One is risk-taking, tolerance for risk or actually traction to it. Another is novelty-seeking, and you put risk-taking and novelty-seeking together, you get what we call thrill-seeking. And the other is the company of one's same-age peers. Now, these are things that we have all our lives, but they peak in the mid-teens. So the puzzle was to answer why that is. If our behavior in our teenage years was just because of slow development, then we would take more risk at 8 and 10 than we would at 14 and 15. Mm-hmm. So what we have to explain is that sort of bubble in the mid-teens. And the best answer for that right now is that that's a stage of development that is adaptive. You have to sort of ask, if you have a set of traits that's that dominant and that pervasive, it's usually an adaptive trait or it wouldn't have survived selection. So this is the argument that these are providing motivations for us to do this thing that we do at that time of life, which is start to move away from the safety, comfort, security, and predictability of home into a world that we need to master to get along. You need something to motivate you, and those sort of tastes, affinities for risk and novelty and same-age peers are just what would work for that.
So let's talk about teenage impulsivity and resistance to temptation. You tell us here about a really interesting experiment with a video game controlled only with eye movement. So in other words, some sort of camera tracks one's eyes along a screen, and that's how you play the game. Tell us a little bit about that experiment.
Yes, it's a very cool study. And it was done by a researcher down at Pittsburgh called, her name is Beatriz Luna. And what you do to take this study is you peer into this little screen. It's something like you do it at the eye doctor sometimes. And there's a little crosshairs in the middle. And every so often, the crosshairs will disappear and a small light will flash elsewhere in the periphery of the screen, off to the side somewhere. And your job, your task, is to not look at the suddenly flickering light, but to keep staring at the little place where the crosshairs was. It's called you can call it a no-look test. Mm-hmm. They call it an anti-saccade test. But it's basically to resist your, measures your ability to resist the impulse to look at something new. Now, it's not really strictly impulsivity. It's more interest in a novel thing. And what they found was at 12-year-olds are 10 and 12-year-olds are not good at this. 15-year-olds are getting pretty good. They're almost as good as adults. And if they are offered a substantial reward, they will perform as good as adults. The big interesting thing that Dr. Luna found there was that when the 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds performed as well as 22-year-olds, they were using different parts of their brains to do so. Hmm. It's as if they had to think a little bit more explicitly, a little bit more consciously to resist a temptation that older people could resist sort of running on sort of an autopilot temptation resistance circuit, if you will. I'm oversimplifying, but that makes it easy to understand. So it shows this maturing brain start to use its different tools and start to weigh different agendas. impulse now versus future reward, that sort of thing. And this is what the brain gets better at as we go through life, and what the teen brain gets a lot better at between 15 and 25. Their computational powers aren't really that different, but they get better at weighing all the different agendas.
Yeah, that's related, I guess, to the fact that the completion of brain development moves in what you describe as a sort of slow wave from the rear parts of the brain up toward the front.
Yes, it's quite fascinating. They show, you can see this in the workups of this long scan study I described that picked up kids from 15 to 30. There's a sort of wave of development that moves from back to front where two things are going on. All the structures are there before, but what's going on is essentially kind of like a wiring. Well, there's first some pruning and then a wiring upgrade. The gray matter around the outside of your brain actually thins during that time because as synapses, those are the connections between neurons, synapses that aren't getting used during that period tend to fade away. They call it synaptic pruning. There's a big pruning job that actually thins the cortex during that period. The other, and this moves from the rear to the evolutionary oldest areas up towards the front of the brain, the frontal cortex, where we do our most sophisticated abstract thinking and tend to weigh different agendas, where we do the so-called executive function. So that's going on, and also going on from back to front is a process called myelination, where the long nerve fibers of the brain get insulated by a fatty substance called myelin. And the result of that is to speed the transmission along those nerve fibers by up to 100 times. So it's like getting a massive network upgrade. And what that higher speed allows is just the sort of networked operation within the brain that lets you kind of carry on a bunch of different computations at once and weigh a bunch of different agendas, what you want in the future, what you want right now, what other people will think of you, draw on the experience you've already accumulated and stored in your memory centers, all these different things we get better at putting together before we act. And that is going on right through and into our 20s and somewhat more slowly after that. And then, of course, the brain starts to slow down a bit.
So it really is more difficult for people in their early teens to sort of gather all this good information that you know you've given them and you know that they've experienced and actually bring that to bear on a decision.
It is. It's harder. And they have a smaller base of their own experience to draw on.
Mm-hmm. I hope I'll remember that some morning at 3 when I've gotten
right.
Terrifying phone call.
As a parent, this can be helpful if you can remember it. Mm-hmm. But the other valuable thing about this sort of, I call this the adaptive adolescent interpretation of this brain development as opposed to the dysfunctional adolescent. Mm-hmm. It is overall adaptive. It causes problems at times. But I think if the parent and the teen can both recognize that this is what's going on, it at least helps you have a common understanding of some of the roots of the behaviors, and so that this person doesn't seem like a creature from another planet.
Journalist David Dobbs is my guest. His article, Beautiful Brains, about the new science of teenage brain development, is the cover story in the October issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Dobbs, who wrote the cover story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Beautiful Brains. It's about the new science of teenage brain development. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, what's the relationship between that reinforcement of myelin sheaths and that pruning of certain neural pathways that begins to take place in early adolescence and the sort of cutoff point for the easy acquisition of a foreign language?
Well, this is an excellent question because the myelination that I described before, which is the insulation of your long axons, nerve fibers in the brain with a fatty sheath of myelin, it speeds up how fast the signals can travel down those wires, if you will. But it comes at a cost because axons communicate and they with other cells by growing little nodes, little branches off of them that reach out and communicate to more cells. And when this insulation is laid down along these axons, it's much harder for any insulated section to grow a new nub and reach out to new cells. So you get better at doing the things you've learned to do, but it gets harder to learn new things. It doesn't become impossible, but it gets harder to. So there's a trade-off there of speed and performance at the things you already can do with the quickness with which you can learn new things. And that's exactly why it's much easier to learn a language earlier in life than later. And the myelination of different parts of your brain happens at different times. And in many parts of the brain with many different tasks, you have a critical period of learning where it's easiest to learn something. So with language in general, that's under 5. If you haven't learned any language by then, it's harder to learn a new one. Movement, it tends to be grammar school and junior high school. That's why most elite athletes started playing a game then. And there's different critical periods throughout. But as the forebrain is myelinated later in adolescence, we get faster and better at sort of doing the things that we already know, but it's a little bit harder to learn new things. The lessons get a little bit locked in, and we get less flexible. And the big thing you learn in adolescence, particularly later adolescence, is how to manage the social world. This is one of the hardest things humans do, managing the social world, and it's absolutely critical to success. So it completely makes sense that this part of the brain would be at this particular balance of performance of current skills and acquisition of new skills, of speed and flexibility during this period. And that's the sort of the hypothesis of why this our forebrain is the last to mature.
So let's talk about those social skills. Everybody who has a teenager, or for that matter, was a teenager, remembers that there's that moment when the last thing you want to do is hang out with your parents or your grandparents or, God forbid, your younger siblings. You only want other teenagers. Why is it so important to them? Is it because they already understand how to manage social relationships with their families?
Well, no, they're still learning that, but they're better at that. We're better at that then than we are with figuring out how the outside world that we're going to live in works.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at it from sort of an investment point of view, it makes sense. You have already, when you're 15, you have already built a tremendous investment up with your family, so much so that you really, really have to screw up for them to throw you out. So you've got them.
Mm-hmm.
But what you need badly to understand and manage and get a secure place in is the social world of your same-age peers. Now, why your same-age peers and not people older than you? Because when you grow up, the people who are your age are going to be the ones running your world. It's them you're going to have to work with, them who will be the adults when you're an adult. So it makes much more sense for you to invest in those relationships and get good at them and win a secure social place in that realm than it does to stay home and just make sure your parents are happy.
Sure, because your parents won't always be out there to look out for you.
Exactly so. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're older, you need to get along with your generation first and foremost. Obviously, others as well, but your generation is where you will make your fate. So there's a whole lot of sense to that, but it's a little bit maddening. And it also explains, though, why those social relations are so intensely important to adolescents. The sense of social, we are exquisitely attuned to how we're doing with our peers when we are teens. And the stakes are high, as I've just described. So it completely makes sense that a teenager would think everything seems to depend on how they're getting along in their social world, because in a sense, it does.
And they're willing to take risks in order to please those peers as well.
They are. And risk, an important thing, I mean, this is the heart of this sort of adaptive adolescent view, is the recognition that these traits that are expressed in an extreme form in adolescence are, all through life, very invaluable human traits. We would not be human beings. We would not be spread all over the globe. We would not have gone to the moon. We would not have developed handwriting or computers if we were averse to risk and novelty. These are very adaptive traits, and the problem during the teen years is when they're expressed in ways that really sharply endanger the teen or other people. So there's risk and there's risk. There's risk driving too fast down the highway. That's not a good way to explore that. There's also risk in when you go to college, as my son did, the same one who was driving way too fast. When he decided to go to college, there's a bunch of safer things he could have done than what he's doing, which is decide to become a journalism major. He's still taking risks. He's still attracted to novelty, but he expresses it by taking a certain course of study and building a way to a career for himself rather than just driving real fast down the highway.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with journalist David Dobbs, author of Beautiful Brains, the cover story of this month's National Geographic magazine. On the line now in Denton, we are speaking with Emily. Hi, Emily.
Hello. My question is, often mental illness is diagnosed during the same period, things like depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. Have your studies shown any relationship between the adaptability of the teen brain and the diagnoses of illnesses like this?
Yes, Emily, that's an excellent question. And you did say my studies. Understand, I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist reporting on this. But no, the two are very much interrelated. This long developmental arc that I've described and the emergence of certain mental illnesses typically during this period, usually late adolescence or around 20, they are very related. And the two, you name the two that are the biggest concern, which are schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Those usually emerge roughly around the age of 20 or in the early 20s, sometimes a little bit before that. And the reason why is because this long arc of development I've described is actually a whole bunch of little arcs that are driven by new gene activity in the brain that sort of gives orders for the development of different areas of the brain to change in some way. And when all those small arcs go well, we get a healthy arc of brain development. Sometimes, though, either by accident or because of the genes you've inherited colliding in a very stressful way with the environment, some of these small arcs of development might go on either too briefly or in some cases too long and create a dysfunction in how the brain's network operates. And in particular cases, that some of these neuroscientists studying development during the adolescence period, they believe that those sorts of mishaps and altered arcs are what can help lead to some of these mental illnesses.
So what about teenagers, David, who are essentially mentally healthy but have these vastly, really intolerably inconsistent moods throughout the day?
You're asking what's driving it or what?
Yeah, well, exactly. Why are they so moody?
Well, they're moody partly because they are so sensitive to reward. Another key thing going on in the brain that is measurable that they've seen along with these other developmental arcs I've described, the brain is particularly attuned during that time to reward. It's reward circuits. And a reward circuit, there's not a single center in the brain that's all about reward. There's one place that changes a lot in association with reward called the nucleus accumbens. But like almost everything else in the human brain, it's a matter of networks. At any rate, there's the reward circuit is dominated by it's largely run by a neurochemical called dopamine. And the brain dopamine has to do with reward and learning, because you learn by getting rewards, and then you learn also by anticipating what's going to happen from something, mm-hmm. right? You learn that if you drop a brick on your foot, it will hurt. That's all about a dopamine reward circuit, believe it or not. And this circuit is exquisitely attuned and also developing during adolescence. So they experience things often, especially social things, much more strongly than they will a few years later. There's also a similar thing going on with oxytocin, but that's kind of the short answer of why the moodiness, and there's also a lot of new hormones kicking in too, which
don't help.
To the fun.
Right.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Ian on the line and Alan. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hi. Yes, I have a quick question for our guest. I was wondering if there's any difference between the ways that a girl's brain develops as compared to a boy's brain.
Yes, there are some differences. The main one is that the girl's brains develop a little faster than boys' brains do. As a group, with any two people, it might not be that way. But as a group, their brains develop a little faster. They develop these executive functions faster than boys. They are tend to indulge in risk in slightly different ways, but the differences overall are not enormous. They both go under these same sort of arcs, and a lot of the behavioral differences we see during the time, some of them are, none of this is hardwired. There's no such thing as hardwired in the brain. There's wiring that interacts with the environment to produce a behavior. But a lot of the differences we see in behavior, of course, culturally driven. And the difference between the development is not that pronounced overall.
I was really surprised to read that teenagers don't think they're invincible and, in fact, tend to overestimate the chances that something will have very bad consequences. We come back again to that issue if they still want the reward more than they care about the consequences. But they don't think that they can't possibly be hurt.
Exactly so. This is one of the wonderful, many wonderful contrary findings in all this field of study, is that people are astonished when you tell them, well, actually, teenagers overestimate risk. And they do. If you give them, a paper test, right, and ask them to things like, what is your statistical chance of getting, pregnant in unprotected sex? What is all these sorts of risk chances? If you go this fast on the highway, what are your percentage chances? They will, across the board, overestimate the actual risk any of these things, situations actually entail. You give the same test to an adult, the adult will also overestimate. They'll overestimate it even more. So there is a difference in how they estimate risk, but it's not that they underestimate risk. They just don't agree with an adult's estimation of risk.
So go ahead.
Where it gets tricky is, as we discussed, they tend to value rewards higher than the adults with. So that further skews kind of their balance.
I'm curious about how we can know that this is an adaptation and it's helpful, because some of the risks that teenagers take, as we know, have consequences that can't be fixed again. As you write in the piece, one out of three teenagers in this country who die in car accidents where they're behind the wheel. It would seem as if this risk-taking puts them at a risk of never surviving into adulthood and having children.
Well, it does. It does. And in writing about these things and talking about them, you need to be careful not to dismiss risk. Risk is important, and as I put in the story, what it comes down to is that the risk of something bad happening at any given time are not that high statistically, but what can happen to them if they're driving really too fast on the highway is horrific. So it's a small statistical risk, but a huge disaster if it happens.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, in a sense, you can't know as a fact that these traits are adaptive more of the time. This is the part of team brain science that's still a hypothesis. You'd have to test it through ways you can't do. You can't take one group of teens and let them take risk and another and let them take risk. But the argument is that more often than not, in some across the population, these traits are adaptive. Just as any trait that survives is adaptive. It means it's successful more often than it's not successful.
And I guess on the whole, you're probably never in a stronger, healthier position to recover, either emotionally or physically, from something that does go wrong than when you're, I don't know, 15, 18, 20 years old.
Right. You're at a very plastic time of life. You can learn a lot of lessons quickly, and you can learn new ones quickly. And you do have a lot of capacity to recover. It does not mean you're immortal. And teens know that. They know they can die, which is why when they're doing something risky, there's part of them that's scared. That's part of the thrill, but they're scared because they know that they're courting trouble.
Let's speak next on the phones with Michael in Dallas. Hey, Michael.
Well, Chris, you were just asking a question that relates to mine. I've thought many times that we should not allow teenagers to drive cars or vote. And, of course, I know that's when I was 18, it seemed like forever before I was 21 and old enough to drink. But that's another thing I don't think teenagers should be allowed to do. But it seems like the risk is not so much just for the teenager, but it's for us as a society. I mean, when teenagers are out there learning how to deal with things, I mean, as he said, one accident and it's all over. And in the history of the human race, you know, cars and things like that are new. And so I know it's a silly thing to say that they shouldn't be allowed to drink, vote, or drive cars, but I'd like to hear his thoughts about that and how it affects our society.
Well, let's do this, Michael. We'll take a quick break, and then we will get a response from David Dobbs. He's a journalist and author of Beautiful Brains, the cover story of this month's National Geographic magazine. If you want to join our conversation about teen brain development, call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's certificate program in financial planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The issue of National Geographic that is on newsstands now has a cover story called Beautiful Brains, written by my guest this hour, journalist David Dobbs. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. David, that's where we heard from Michael in the last segment, who said, not entirely facetiously, maybe we need to keep adolescents from driving or drinking or voting or doing anything that could have permanent consequences. What do you think about that, and what do scientists think about the need to allow them to take some risks?
Well, no, Michael has an excellent question. It's a difficult one. It's clear, as we've been discussing, that kids will take more risks when we're teenagers. So should we be allowed to take them in cars? There are ways. Some states have, Vermont, where I live, is one of them, have created laws that restrict the situations in which people can drive in their first year or two or even longer of having their driver's license after they're 16. And one common one is that they can't have friends in the car. They can't have anyone under 18 or 25 in the car with them. And at first this seems like a silly rule, but it actually makes sense because research has shown that teenagers will take more risks with their friends around than they will on their own. So that's one thing that makes sense. You could consider waiting until 18 to give them driver's license. However, that works against things like, it can, in many parts of the country, including most of Texas, I grew up in Houston, that would really make it hard for a lot of teenagers to hold down high school jobs.
Mm-hmm.
and therefore work against the very important job they need to do of integrating with society. Part of what's a problem here is the necessity to use cars to get around. And drinking is a problem, but if you think about teenage drinking, the problem is it's most intense when they drink and drive. So in a way, if you look at the car rather than the bottle as the problem, you're a lot closer to the cause of death. That I'm not quite sure what to do about. In researching the story, I looked at the death rates in teenagers in countries where the driving age typically came a lot later. And there are other cultural differences, of course. But nowhere are they as high in the United States in countries where car use is not common among teenagers. So it's this combination of the risk-taking and the ubiquity of cars that is a huge part of the problem. If you can reduce the situations in which they're going to drive at risk, obviously you'll have a win.
Obviously, having other teens in the car is going to be a distraction. There's conversation going on and loud music. But I recall, and I was a teenager long before anybody had a cell phone or any of those things to distract them, but there's that sense when you're, 17 that you want to look cool while you're driving and not look like you're so bothered by something like the speed limit. Is that what accounts for this, or is there something else at play here?
No, that is. And, we call it peer pressure, whatever you name anything you want, but it's very real. One of the scientist I spent a lot of time talking to, a man named Larry Steinberg at Temple University, he created a little driving test for just exactly this, as a matter of fact. He made up a game where, a video game on the computer, where you had to drive through town and you got a reward for the lowest possible time, but you had to stop at red lights. And you were confronted several times with the yellow lights and had to make a very quick decision whether to speed through the yellow light or stop. Okay. If you sped through it and it turned red, you lost a whole bunch of time. So it rewarded some risk, but not too much.
Mm-hmm.
First time he gave the test to this, the test takers were alone taking it. And the teenagers did as well as the 25-year-olds did, and 25 to 35-year-olds did. Okay. So they didn't drive that differently. When you put friends in the room, you put a friend with the teenager and then an adult friend with the adult, the adult drove about the same. The teenagers took many more risks.
Hmm.
So it's the simple presence of someone else in the car, your age, when you're 15 or 16 or 17 or 18, will make you drive with more risk.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, we speak with Paul in Hearst. Hello, Paul.
Hi. Yeah, my question goes to nature versus nurture, the effect of parenting on brain development. I have relatives, friends who say, that's just the way they were, that's just the way they are. As to excuse, I think, negative parenting versus really a positive, happy home, positively reinforcing home. And then you indicated, Dr. Hobbs,
Mr. Dobbs.
Dobbs.
David Dobbs. I'm not a doctor, though.
Okay. Journalist Dobbs. There's adaptation in a child growing. I think you gave the illustration of dropping a brick on the foot, and so one learns. And I'm just wondering, in the general area of adaptation, is that an evolutionary thing such that when there is positive parenting or negative parenting, does that actually affect, can it affect change chromosomally, the organism that in brief time or long time adapts?
What do we know about that, David?
This is an excellent question. Parenting won't actually change your DNA, but it will affect, it can affect, in a sense, what your DNA does. I got to handle this without getting too deep into the scientific weeds here, but the distinction between nature and nurture is one that's one of convenience, but it's somewhat false, because who you are and what you do comes out of a long, ongoing conversation
mm-hmm.
between the genes and you're given, who create the physical body you are and everything in you, and their interaction with the outside world. And this has been shown in bounteous research. There's a conversation going all the time inside your cells that make you who you are. It's nature meeting nurture, genes meeting environment. So, and many, many studies have shown that one's environment has a huge amount to do with what you grow up into, including the, you know, your dominant environment when you're very young, which is the home you grow up in and the parenting you receive, and later on, of course, your schoolmates and school and so on. So, yes, we can't get away, even though sometimes we'd like to, just blaming things on someone's genes. It's always a conversation between the genes and the environment, the nature and the nurture, if you will.
It is interesting, though, and you refer to this in the piece, adolescence has always been adolescence, at least as long as we have written records. Shakespeare wrote about, you know, teenagers and what a pain they can be.
Yes.
And it's every culture, too. It's not just westernized American culture that causes this kind of behavior.
Right. This is important to recognize. You do hear, and I ran into this when I was working on the story, people would say, "What, isn't this just kind of a Western construct, adolescence?" Well, the answer is yes, but mostly no. The exact form adolescence takes, you know, people listening to music and driving cars, that's clearly a modern Western thing. But the one really wide, rigorous study, which is done for a 1991 book called Adolescence, an Anthropological Inquiry, looked at 200-plus cultures all around the world, now and before, many of them pre-industrial nature, and almost every single one had the culture recognized a period that was essentially adolescence, a period in which there's a yearning to get out on your own and a straining for independence, but you're not considered quite ready to get there yet. Sometimes they're shorter than ours, but culture doesn't create adolescence. It shapes its expression, but it's pretty much a human universal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Carolyn in Fort Worth. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
I have my own guesses and answers to my questions. I'd like to hear what he has to say. How does this, sometimes we see this carried, the lack of...
You want to talk about risk and reward, is that right,
Carolyn? Risk, yeah, and the ones and the people that seem to always go for the reward in adult life, as in wheeler dealing and other things. And I was just want to hear his comments. Is that a lack of development in the brain, or what would he say about that?
I don't think it's a lack of development in the brain. It's a different sort of development. You know, there's a huge range within humans, thank goodness, of traits and personality types. Some people are more risk-averse than others. Some people are friendlier to risk. And there are actually specific gene variants that are associated with heightened risk-taking throughout life. There's a dopamine processing gene called DRD4 that has two forms. If you have one particular form, you're more likely to take risk than another and seek out novelty and so on. So this is, I think, a variation in human development and also in how you are raised, what kind of rewards you've received as you go along to taking risks. And I wouldn't characterize people necessarily, just the willingness to take risk, as dysfunctional. That's how we discover, you know, Columbus discovered North America. That's how we went to the moon. And if you think about the traits that we've described as being particularly height at adolescence, risk and novelty, the company of peers. Think of Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak in their garage, two buddies taking huge risks, trying to do something new with computers. This is how the Apples and the Googles and the IBMs, this is how the new economies are built. This is how we explore new frontiers. Absolutely crucial human behavior, I think. And the problem is that occasionally they lead you somewhere you shouldn't go.
So even recognizing the advantages of this time in life, it can be hard for us to witness as parents. And I was thinking that in some ways our attitude toward teenagers is like it is toward Congress. You know, as a whole, we grumble about them, but we love our own, you know? So what have you learned about when to sort of let them take risks and make some mistakes, and when to intervene?
This is, you know, that's really the hard question of parenting a teenager. And you know, when I think back a few years to when my son, 21 now, was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was rough times. The thing I wanted to know the most was if I could look ahead and see him at 25 and know he was fine, how much easier it would all be.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're out of science and into opinion, but it seems to me that if you look at this science and what is going on, then there's two things that can be a great help. One, your job is to have a safe place to return to and a person they can trust, and pick your battles and when you set limits and keep them out of disaster. You don't want them to die. You don't want them to get pregnant unwanted. You don't want them to get addicted. If you can do those, you can keep in mind that down the line, the behaviors that are making you just nuts, they're going to get better, the vast majority of people, because these things peak. You're at a peak from 15 to 17, and then the risk-taking drops off sharply. That's one thing. And the other thing is to use their preference for peer age wisdom, as it were, same age peer wisdom. You're not 15 anymore, but you were once. And I think if you can pick your spots to present good advice, not so much as from dad or mom, the authority figure, but that and also dad or mom, the person who was once your age and faced a similar situation that your child is facing now, and how you got out of it, got through it, or failed to, and what you learned from that failure. That lets them learn from you both as a parent and as a peer. And there's no science behind that, but it seems to me that it's consistent with the science and their high value they give to experience one at the time rather than looking back.
And do the brilliant scientists that you interviewed for this article and a lot of your other work, do they wring their hands as much as everybody else when it comes to their own families?
Generally off record, but yes.
Yes, off the record.
No, they're in the same kind of situations, you know, and some of the people I talk to, I'm not going to name anyone, but, mm-hmm. you know, some of these people, they've had kids that are really giving them a rough time. Others are getting that rare, really smooth ride. But, you know, misery loves company, right? It helps to know that most people struggle during this period because it's, this is a very predictable sort of rise of traits. Some express it in more troubling fashion than others, and a few meet disaster, of course. But it's a universal situation.
David Dobbs wrote the cover story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine. It is on newsstands now, and the article is called Beautiful Brains. David, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Well, it was a real pleasure to come down to Texas, even if just electronically. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.